Matthew 20, if you would please stand with me and as we continue to worship the Lord through the reading of his word. Starting in verse 29. Now as they went out of Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out, saying, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." Then the multitude warned them that they should be quiet. But they cried out all the more, saying, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." So Jesus stood still and called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Lord, that our eyes may be opened." So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight and they followed him. Please be seated. As we continue to go through the Gospels chronologically, we see that we're very, very close to the time of the Passover, where Jesus would celebrate his last Passover, the one that he desired to celebrate more than any other. He's within days of reaching Jerusalem. He is coming from a place called Jericho, which you might remember from the Old Testament. It's one of the most traveled roads from Galilee to Jerusalem, is through Jericho. And it's roughly, 12, 13 miles from Jerusalem. So when he came to Jericho, he was getting closer and closer to his fate, something that he had decided, before time began, that had to happen. And as he got closer to this time, it says that he set his face like a flint. He was absolutely undeterred in his desire to go to the cross. Now, one of the things that you might encounter, especially from folks that like to criticize the Bible and criticize its inerrancy, is that there seem to be a couple of discrepancies here that we need to clear up. They're very easily explained. There are two Jerichos that are mentioned here, and basically in the gospel it says that Jesus was coming into Jericho, and while the other was saying he was coming out when this occurred. Well, which is it? There's two Jerichos. There was one that was cursed after it was destroyed in the battle with Joshua. We've all remember that kid song, right? It was destroyed completely when it was cursed. And they attempted several times to rebuild on that ancient site, but it never happened. The city would fail time after time after time. Well, Herod the Great then built a much newer city that was very close, within a mile or so of the original Jericho. And it had sunken gardens, it had reflecting pools, it had palaces. It was a beautiful area. And he called that Jericho as well. So in one gospel, it's saying he's coming out of Jericho. In the other gospels, it's saying that he is coming into it. For instance, Matthew, who was a Jew, by the way, and was speaking to a Jewish audience, would have said they went out of Jericho, his Jewish audience would have immediately thought of this old site, being familiar with it. It's important, again, because Matthew and Mark says this occurs as they were going out. Luke, who was not a Jew, says as they were coming in. So he's thinking of the newer Jericho. Very easy to explain. Matthew states that there were two blind beggars, but Luke concentrates on one. Mark 10:46 says the blind man's name was Bartimaeus, which means the son of Timaeus. So again, just as you read these things, and as people try to bring these contradictions, and I say that with quotes, contradictions up, very easily explained. If there were two blind beggars, then there was definitely one. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter the number. Really, it matters more what's trying to be communicated. And the gospel, while it is history, the biggest thing that we have to concentrate on is not that, it's got all of the facts absolutely correct, because in our newspapers today, that doesn't happen. In our news reporting today, there's just certain pieces of information that are brought together. That's why they're called, by the way, the Synoptic Gospels, because together they bring a synopsis of what's going on. The important part of it being that they're communicating the truth that God wants us to hear. So, don't sweat the details, and when somebody tries to bring those kind of things up to you, just love on them. There are two things here that this addresses. One is the obvious response to prayer that Jesus offers, even in probably one of the most tumultuous times in his life. He knows what he's coming into, you know, and instead of concentrating on the cross and the agony of the cross, he is still very much serving the people. And he would do that all the way up until the time that that he had Passover. If you recall, that was the night that he just, that beautiful response to their arguing was when he washed their feet. So he never stopped serving, even up to and including, of course, the cross. So we see that response to this man as he's going towards Jerusalem for this very, very important journey. And how often do we do that? We blow past people, not even seeing them sometimes, because what we're doing is so stinking important. Well, there was nothing more important than what Jesus was doing, and yet he heard the cries of a blind man. And we can be assured that we have that same ear. And the second thing is, this is a picture of being healed from spiritual blindness. It's a contrast between those who were seeing without believing and those who were believing without sight. And so these two blind men gain the attention of Jesus. I mean, he's walking through. Again, this is a large crowd that's funneling in. You know, this isn't, you know, like today where you jump in the car and you go. They're walking, and, you know, they're riding, you know, burden, you know, animals. So it's a large crowd, and normally there was quite a caravan coming through for these type of feasts. You know, Jerusalem would swell to about 2 to 3 million people during these obligation feasts, such as Passover. So there was a constant stream, and, you know, you would get in early and make sure you get a room. And so there was this constant commotion, and this man being blind, or these two men that were blind, it was very common, very common. And there was no cure for blindness. So basically, they were reduced to begging. So they looked forward to these times, to these feasts, you know, and they make sure that they pick that spot, you know, and there's a whole lot of traffic coming through from Jerusalem from Jericho to Jerusalem, I should say. And it's a great time of year to do that. You know, think of how the retailers feel about, you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, if we don't get it now, we ain't getting it, you know. And that's kind of where they were with begging. So they would pick that spot because many pilgrims along the way would give, you know, some rejoicing because God had been so good to them, and they're just overflowing with goodness, you know, and they're overflowing with the goodness of God. And so they're so excited, and they're very charitable, you know, and that's what happens basically with religious people. And so these guys are positioning themselves, making sure, you know, that they're in the right spot to receive some kind of alms. Others, of course, are trying to get in that one last good deed to curry favor with the Lord before they hit Jerusalem. So either way, these guys are scoring, okay? You know, and this might be, again, what they depend upon for the rest of the year. You know, they're not going out and splurging this. This is sustenance for them. Now, these two blind men are a picture of the spiritual blindness of the world. There's an entire spiritual realm that operates around us that we simply cannot see if we try to look with our eyes. In John 1, 4 through 5, and in verse 9, it says, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. This was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world." Now, survey after survey would tell you that if anybody had a choice, not that anybody would want to make that choice, but if anybody had a choice to lose a limb, to lose their hearing, or to lose their sight, far and above, their sight was what they wanted to retain more than anything else, because everything else they could somewhat compensate for. But as soon as you lose your sight, you're in darkness. You're in dark, complete and total darkness. I had the opportunity several years ago to go to Mammoth Cave, and I don't know if you guys have been there or not, but there's one cave, and there are several of these throughout the United States, but the one that I've been to is in Mammoth Cave. And they told us to, you know, shut off all cell phones, shut off, you know, all sources of light completely, and be completely still and completely silent. And they closed the door, and it was the only time I've ever experienced absolute darkness. And to me, it was palpable. To me, it was one of the most excruciating 45 seconds I'd ever had in my life. And that's all it was. It was just about, but it felt like forever. because I could not see. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. And in those situations, your eye will immediately be attracted to any source of light, no matter how small it is. And that is our desire. But because of our wickedness, it says, Scripture says that men like to live in darkness. They want to reject the light. And 1 Peter 2:9 says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." In 2 Corinthians 4:43, it says, "But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing," and this is important, "it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them." And of course, John 3:19 says, "And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil." So these men were sitting in darkness, and we can see, as they sat in darkness physically, it certainly is a picture of how we sit before we come to know Christ, and the darkness that was there, and the things that we cannot see, absolutely cannot see or refuse to see. So they're sitting there, can't see a thing. And it says, when they heard that Jesus was passing by. Now, if you also may know that if one sense is removed, then other senses begin to heighten, and certainly hearing does. And in a very, very small way, you can test out that theory. Just go to bed, and have music playing. As soon as you turn out the light, that music gets louder. It's amazing how that happens. It just, you just settle in, and all of a sudden what you could not hear all of a sudden is too much, too loud. And so, again, the senses become more acute. And as these guys were, sounds like they were blind for most of their life, if not from birth. And so their senses were very acute. They were able to listen for certain patterns in traffic. They were able to listen for things that were happening. Somebody had told them, or maybe they were hearing it from the crowd, Jesus is here, Jesus is coming, that his popularity at this point is amongst the people is reaching its absolute peak. Amongst, of course, the leaders, it's their opposition to him is beginning to reach its peak. But anyway, so he's coming through, and they're saying, Jesus is here, Jesus is in the crowd. And so they're excited. They're saying, oh my gosh, Jesus is here. And so that they're thinking this may be their last time to meet Jesus. They had this desperate need that was certainly appropriate for those that know that maybe today is it. Something that we need to communicate to those who don't know the Lord even today. Today may be it. We don't know the day or the hour. But they had a desperation because they knew their need for Jesus. And so there was a change in the dynamic of the crowd. They knew that Jesus was in the area, but they couldn't see him, but he could hear him. So as he heard this multitude passing by, he's asking what it meant. And, he's hearing the shuffling of the feet, and he's hearing that Jesus is there. So simply because he couldn't see Jesus, he didn't say, oh, well, he must not be there because I can't see him. So instead of giving up, because he could not seek Jesus by sight, he sought Jesus the only way that he could, by hearing. That's what we have today. The Lord has given us his word, and we can see Jesus through the hearing of his word. And so they begin to cry out, and they persisted in crying out in spite of the obstacles in their way, in spite of the fact that they could not see him, in spite of the fact that they had to raise their voice over the crowd, and we'll see a little bit later in the text that they actually get threatened, just to be quiet. And they cry out, "Have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David." It's this incredible earnestness. They were desperate to be healed, and they ignored the crowd to quiet them. And it says they cried out all the more. That was on cue, by the way. They cried out all the more. The crowd was threatening them. Shut up. shut, you know, and these guys are defenseless. And yet, they're so desperate for Christ. They're so desperate for Jesus that there's no way that they're going to let this small thing stand between them and their healing. You know, whenever we feel the enemy come against us and begin to rebuke us as we're crying out to the Lord, let's cry out all the more. Let's never be silent. Whether that's in our personal lives or more and more in the marketplace where we see that it's becoming less and less acceptable. We need to cry out all the more. And that's what he did. The man heard Jesus was passing by. He was desperate to get his attention. He was not going to be embarrassed. He didn't care, and he wouldn't shut up. He knew that Jesus was the Son of David, meaning he knew that Jesus was the Messiah. He kept shouting for his mercy. And it's been pointed out that there's a difference in when it talks about that they cried out the first time, you know, showing the blind man's great desperation. You know, at Luke 18, it uses one word where it says he's cried out. So that's this loud shout to attract attention, you know, much like we would, you know, shout at our kids, you know, across the playground or something to grab their attention or something. And that's what that means, is cried out. But later on, the word that says cried out all the more, it's been described as the instinctive cry of ungovernable emotion, a scream, an animal cry. Son of David, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. Because they knew this was their shot. And it was this undeniable passion for Jesus. Forget the obstacles. It was this undeniable passion for Jesus. That's what leads to revival in our own hearts. You want revival in this land? Start right where you're standing. Let nothing, let no one deny that passion for Jesus, knowing that he is your only hope. This man knew that being the Messiah, that's why he referred to him as Son of David, the Messiah, that one of the signs of the Messiah was healing the blind. And Isaiah 61:1, actually, Luke 4:18 quotes Isaiah 61:1. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of the sight of the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." He knew if indeed Jesus was the Messiah, Jesus could heal him of his blindness. Now, his blindness completely identified him. You know, as a matter of fact, if you've grown up in the church, what do you know? How do you know Bartimaeus? Blind Bartimaeus, right? That's how we know Bartimaeus. That's how he was identified. That's how he was identified in the early church, blind Bartimaeus. He should have been formerly known as blind Bartimaeus, but Bartimaeus' blindness completely identified him. It was a result of the fall. You know, we're all marked by the fall. We're all marked by that original sin. But some of us allow ourselves to be completely identified by that sin. Addictions, tendencies towards anger, tendencies towards gluttony. I want you to accommodate my weakness because I am unwilling to confront my sin. We're all subject to the fall, but we cannot be identified by that sin. Sometimes we identify so strongly that we demand others treat us differently because of it. The other thing that we need to understand is that we have no resources within ourselves to change that. Just like Bartimaeus, he couldn't all of a sudden just restore his sight. I think, you know, certainly if he had that capability, you know, given the fact that he was crying out to Jesus, we know the man's character enough to say he did not want to be identified with his weakness. In much the same way, is that how we want to be identified, is by our weakness? Or do we want to be identified by the strength that Jesus gives us? the strength of Jesus himself. So it says, after this cry, Jesus stood still. Now, this was a man on a mission. This was a man determined to go to Jerusalem, and nothing was going to stop him. No, that was going to deter him. There was nothing that was going to stop him from getting to Jerusalem. And yet he stood still because of the honest, forthright, passionate plea for mercy. We have that same ear. And so it says that Jesus called for them. And he asked others in the crowd to bring them to him. So those same people that were just, you know, telling him to shut up, are now all of a sudden, oh, Jesus wants to see you, you know, fickle people. And, you know, so they get him and they guide him to Jesus. And they're standing in front of Jesus. Clearly, the question that Jesus asks is not to be sarcastic. It's not because he didn't understand the situation. He asked them, what do you want me to do for you? This wonderful, simple question God has not stopped asking. Now, sometimes we go without when God would want us to give us something simply because we will not answer this question. What do you want me to do for you? And according to James 4:2, often we don't have because we don't ask. Very often the responding to this question is that clarifying point that reveals our priorities. That's why Jesus asked it not only here but several other times. What do you want me to do for you? Because that clarifies in our own minds and our own hearts our priorities. James 4:3 continues on and says, you ask and do not receive because you ask amiss. As we're asking God for these things, we're clarifying what is important in our own heart. You know, if you recognize that God is not answering your prayer, sometimes it's because God wants you to, because there is a wait involved, because there is a, this is not the time yet. But a lot of times it's because we don't even know what we're asking for. We don't even know what we want. We don't even know what our priorities are. You know, and when I first got saved, I was taught early on that, you know, a truism that what's down in the well comes up in the bucket, you know? And so examine your prayer life. What is it you're asking for? Because that really is the condition of your heart. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked this question with full knowledge that these men were blind. He knew what they needed. He knew what they wanted. But God still wants us to tell him our needs as a constant expression of trust and reliance on him. So he says, Lord, that I may receive my sight. Now this blind man knew how to submit to Jesus. He called Jesus Lord and asked to receive his sight. Now, sometimes when we see Lord in the New Testament, we see it as master or we see it as teacher. But, you know, when Bartimaeus was crying out, he was using that national messianic title, Son of David. You know, he was identifying him as the Messiah, the Son of David. But now he calls Jesus Lord, Rabboni. Not teacher, not master, Rabboni. We only find this used one other time, and that's when Mary Magdalene was at the tomb. And it's an expression of personal faith. He wanted a relationship with Jesus. He desired Jesus. He didn't just desire the healing. He desired Jesus. So Jesus says, receive your sight. Your faith has made you well. So Jesus grants this man's request and heals him of his blindness. Now think about this for a moment. Sight requires that memory be built. You know, think about a baby, a newborn baby. It's several weeks before they can see because they're starting to register pictures. And they're starting to register colors and shades. And so memory has to be built into the, you know, because basically the eye is part of the brain's, you know, it's just an extension of the brain, you know. And it's the lens into the brain and that what captures all that stuff. And by the way, we are nowhere close, no matter how amazing our supercomputers are, there is absolutely nothing that even approaches what the eye can do. absolutely nothing. But sight requires that memory be built, and it takes a long time. As a person's eyesight is restored, you know, as it's restored, they have that memory, and so it's a matter of recalling it. If the person was born blind and knows nothing, if they were to have eyesight given to them, they would have to learn how to see. But when Jesus gave Bartimaeus his sight, he gave it to him completely and immediately. Now, I don't know. I think Bartimaeus was a little bit of a disadvantage, because when his sight was restored, he saw the most beautiful thing he would ever see in his life. Everything else from there was downhill. Jesus connected the man's healing with the man's faith. And David Gusick says it this way: there were many notable aspects of this man's faith that made him ready to receive from Jesus. It was faith that wanted Jesus. It was faith that knew who he was. It was faith that knew what he deserved from Jesus. It was faith that could tell Jesus what it wanted. It was faith that could call Jesus Lord. So the first thing that Bartimaeus did, it says he received his sight and he followed him, glorifying God. That was his purpose in life. That was his desire, was to glorify God. Now healed, now saved. You know, he is seeing Jesus for who he is. And he begins to follow him. You know, and the way that Jesus is going, it doesn't matter that he's going to Jerusalem, you know. And this man doesn't necessarily know where Jesus is going or what he's going to do. The disciples certainly didn't, and Jesus had told them many times, and they still didn't get it. But it didn't matter. He was going to follow Jesus regardless. That's how he got to Jesus. It didn't matter the opposition. So they went from darkness to light, from being beggars to being inheritors of the kingdom of God. This was especially significant considering that Jesus was on his way towards Jerusalem to die. How do we take this home? First of all, we cannot dismiss Jesus' compassionate response as he gets closer to the cross. We see time and time again where he denies his own self-interest and tends to the needs of others. We see that right up to the moment that he takes his last breath. His concern was for his mother on the cross. His concern was for the thief on the cross. His concern was for so many others. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So we see Jesus' compassionate response. I cling to the fact that he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's never too busy to hear my cry, to hear my shriek. And secondly, we've heard that seeing is believing. We've heard that term, that phrase before. I could describe the Grand Canyon to you in detail or anything else in detail, and yet not be believed until you take it in yourself. You know, there are still people believe that we haven't landed on the moon. You know, and even having seen something without the proper understanding to take it in, we can't fully apprehend belief. In contrast, we have the capacity to see what beyond what is in front of us. We have that capacity to see beyond what is in front of us. Think about this. No building, no invention, no institution came into existence without someone seeing what was not yet there. It requires belief. And we see here the words in this passage were spoken between Jesus and two physically blind men within the hearing of hard-hearted people who had seen the signs that Jesus performed and yet opposed him. They saw the signs. This was within days of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and the people that were there didn't fall down before him in awe and begin to glorify God. They ran to the leaders and tattled. These were hard-hearted men. And Jesus was speaking these words between himself and these two physically blind men within the hearing of these hard-hearted people. Had seen him perform these things and yet opposed him. The response of the blind men is to be the cry of our own heart. Lord, that our eyes may be opened. Open to see beyond what is in front of us. These men saw Jesus so much more clearly than those with working eyes. And as somebody who is saved, as somebody who is spiritually reborn, as somebody who has been imbued with the Holy Spirit, you have a spiritual capacity to see with your heart beyond what your eyes tell you. And you do that without abandoning reason. And it's the gift of grace that produces faith in our lives to allow us to see beyond what our own eyes can see. Bartimaeus was not willing to accept his condition, but he cried out to the only one who could change it. How often have we come to live with our own sins, our own sin condition as inevitable, and not cried out to God to change us? How often have we allowed obstacles to stand between us and a relationship with God simply because we're too embarrassed by what the crowd is saying, by what our friends are saying, by what our family is saying? How often do we allow desperation or fear to keep from asking of God the things that He wants us to ask of Him? What do you want from me? What do you want from me?